So our next speaker is an incredible activist. She's part of the Black Lives Matter here in Chicago. Everyone give a round of applause to Ms. Aislinn Pulley.
How y'all feeling tonight? Whew, y'all are really beautiful. I want to give honor to some of the folks who are not here right now, as well as some of the folks that have been holding us down. We have Gerald Reed's mom here, Armanda Shackelford. And what happened on Wednesday and what continues to happen in his case is an atrocity. We need every single person that's in here to sign the petition to demand the immediate release of Gerald Reed. So Big Tree, where are you? All right, can y'all just look at Big Tree, raise your hand. We need y'all to sign the petition, so go and find Big Tree after this so that we can get everyone's names down. I also wanna kind of take a minute to remember why we're in Chicago. A lot is going on in this city, and a lot has been done in this city. We heard from the GOAT, Stacey Davis Gates, earlier, who helped situate us in the historic SEIU-CTU win that just happened. Chicago is where the first charter school strikes happened in this country. Chicago is the city that successfully kicked out our state's attorney, Anita Alvarez. And we followed that up by successfully kicking out Rahm Emanuel. We unseated a decades-long judge here, Judge Cochran, from the bench, the first time that has ever happened in this city. We forced Dante Servin, the murderous CPD cop who killed Rekia Boyd, to resign. Dante Servin tried to get his record expunged. And just this week, we were able to successfully prevent that from happening. Chicago is where we recently elected 6 alder people who identify as socialists to our city council. We have the most socialist identified city council people in the country right now. So when the reports about how historic this election was, omit that and talk about our cop mayor instead. Set them straight. That is the victory. We also have, for the first time, convicted a white on-duty police officer for murdering a black person in the history of this city. In addition to all of those things, young black organizers forced the reopening, the reestablishment of a Trauma One Center on the South Side. And led by Angela Davis and Critical Resistance, as mentioned earlier, Chicago has made important contributions to the fight for abolition. Chicago won a historic reparations ordinance in 2015. This is the first ordinance of its kind in this country that provides not only financial redress for survivors of police torture, but mandated the creation of a curriculum to be taught in all Chicago public schools about that history. In addition, the ordinance provided free access to all of the Chicago City colleges for not just the survivors, but for their family members and extended family members. The ordinance also called for the creation of a public memorial, which is important because what torture attempts to do is to erase and invisibilize. And a public memorial makes visible and tangible what was supposed to be erased and systemically ignored and denied real and permanent. That is a victory that it was won. We should celebrate that. But the fight is not over because the memorial has not been made. Rahm Emanuel, all right, feds. All right, we see you. Rahm Emanuel denied the funding to establish the public memorial. Lori Lightfoot, to date, has not responded to the demand to create and fund the public memorial. Right. So our work is not done. The promise of reparations has not yet been fulfilled. What the reparations ordinance also called for was the creation of a center located on the south side to treat the psychological effects of torture. That center is the Chicago Torture Justice Center. It is the first, and it is currently the only center in the whole United States dedicated to survivors of domestic torture. The city rejected our proposal for full funding and only gave us half of that funding. So while we have these historic victories, we need to defend them because they can easily be taken away. And what the city said off the record, and I'm saying this off the record, but I'm also looking at some of our city council folks who are in here, so y'all know, they said to us that the reparations ordinance did not mandate any funding beyond what it has already done. So there's an implicit threat there. So we need to prepare to defend these victories and make sure that they remain permanent. Because as we heard, we still have torture survivors incarcerated right now. And they need to be freed, all of them. And the names that we know are a tip of the iceberg of what the reality is. We have 120 names from John Burge. John Burge trained tons of detectives under him. They were known as the Midnight Crew. That was only one of the crews. They are still on the force. One of them was a part of the Laquan McDonald assassination. So we can see that connection, that lineage is alive and well, and it's in the heart of that torture remains alive and well right now. So when they talk about the era of Burge, don't let them use that language, because the torture continues to happen. And we have tons and tons of survivors who don't yet know that they also are connected to Burge and his henchmen. What we do have here today and this weekend are survivors who are going to be here and sharing their stories. And I want to make some of them present, both who are physically here, some who remain incarcerated. Latanya Jennifer Sublett is a woman torture survivor. We never hear about the women torture survivors. There are women torture survivors. She will be here. Stanley Howard, he is not here. He was one of the death row 10 whose fight helped enable the moratorium on the death penalty to be put in place in Illinois. His wife, Michelle, is here. Michelle, where are you? There she is. Carl Williams remains incarcerated. His wife is here. Talia, raise your hand. And we have Anthony Holmes and Gregory Banks and Mark Clements. We have Bertha Escamilla, who's a mom of a torture survivor who's here. Bertha, raise your hand. We have Regina. Regina, who is here. Regina, where are you? Right over there. Raise your hand. So what we know, ooh, is that Marvin Reeves back there? Marvin. Marvin is a torture survivor. So what we know empirically is that when we fight, we win. What we also know is that we are not yet done fighting. Because right now we have Holman Square. Holman Square disappeared over 7,000 people between 2004 and 2012. We know that torture is not over in this city. We know that torture is not an aberration, but is the norm. So that 120 names, that 120 names is not the real number. And the work that we have to do is to end torture completely in this city and across this country. And what that means is that we have to free all the prisoners, we have to open all the cages, and we have to defund all the police departments. So while we are here and we are standing in the victory of the struggles and the fights that brought us here and that have changed the landscape to where the only viable option for a mayor in this city happened to be a Black queer woman, we have a long way to go. So this is just the beginning, and we ain't done. Our fight ain't even been started. It's getting started, and we gonna win, because when we fight, we win. When we fight, we win. When we fight,
we win.
When we fight,
we win.
When we fight,
we win.
Make some noise if you're ready to fight. So up next, I would like to invite up Jess Sundin from the committee. Ooh, it sounds like y'all already know who she is. She's from the Committee to Stop FBI Repression. Make some noise.
Thank you, Jasmine. Hello, Chicago. I'm a little small, well, this way anyway. Greetings in solidarity from the city of Jamar Clark, Minneapolis. From the state that took the lives of Justin Teagan and Isaac Aiden and Brian Quinones and so many others. I come to you first of all, so thankful to be here with you, and so thankful that I work with the Twin Cities Coalition for Justice for Jamar that was able to mobilize people to come out and be here today. That's not actually my topic today. See, I'm going to tell like an old story. Nine years ago, one morning, my family had a very rude awakening. Early morning raid by the FBI. They came armed with battering rams, warrants to search our homes for evidence of so-called material support to foreign terrorists, and subpoenas ordering my wife and I to appear before a grand jury here in your city, in Chicago. Well, we came to Chicago, but we didn't go to that grand jury. But, you know, we learned while the FBI was still in our house that actually dozens of agents were at the doors of activists and comrades across the country, including here in Chicago. We were from many mass movements, including the anti-war and international solidarity movement, the Palestinian Liberation Movement. We were trade unionists, and some of us were members of Freedom Road Socialist Organization. In total, 23 of us were targeted in that operation. And out of our case, they went on to attack Carlos Montes and Resmia Ode, who you heard from earlier this evening. But even before the agents left our home, we knew that we were not going to cooperate with that grand jury. We did refuse to help the government destroy our movements or those we worked in solidarity with in Palestine or Colombia or anywhere else. We knew when we made that decision that our refusal could send us to prison, and as it had, in fact, many times before, many people before us, many people in this city with the same prosecutor behind their cases. But we also knew that, like so many who have come before us, our only defense was solidarity. I want to give a shout out to my fellow grand jury resistors, some of whom are here tonight. You can shout now if y'all want to, like, that's like a whole bunch of us are here right now. But I also want to thank many of you, our folks who stood to defend us. And I thank you because it was not only our refusal to testify, but your refusal to let them take us that is the reason that I am here today. I absolutely believe I owe my freedom to this movement, to these movements. And the government absolutely failed in its attempt to silence us. And instead, we grew stronger. So we're here today on this truly historic occasion, and we're doubling down. Together, we are refounding the National Alliance as a powerful weapon to defend all of our movements and our communities like never before. Speaking for the Committee to Stop FBI Repression, I say we are with you for the long haul to confront racist and political repression and racist police terror as long as it exists in this country. So I'm gonna end quick because I know there's other people you're kind of interested in hearing from, but let's say it real loud so they can hear us. Ain't no power, let the power of the people, because the power of the people don't stop. Say what? Ain't no power, let the power of the people, because the power of the people don't stop. Ain't no power like the power of the people, because the power of the people don't stop.
Say what? Ain't no power like the power of the people, because the power of the people don't stop.
Give it up for Jess Sundin, everyone. We are almost to Angela's keynote address. Make some noise if you're excited to see Angela Davis. Freaking amazing. Okay, so CPAC, as you all may know, is an ordinance in the Chicago City Council. And we, in total, have 19 aldermen who have signed on to CPAC. And we have a couple of them here in the room tonight. So I want to invite up Alderman Carlos Rosa, the 35th Ward, the sponsor of CPAC and the people's alderman, to say some words. Make some noise for Carlos Rosa.
Good evening, sisters and brothers, and siblings, and comrades, and friends. You know, my other chief co-sponsor here, Jeanette Taylor of the 20th Ward, unfortunately, she had to step out this evening. But I just want to say that this is a tremendous, tremendous night here in the city of Chicago, because people are waking up across this country, and because the people here in this room recognize that at the same time that we wake up, there's people trying to keep us down. That at the same time that we open our eyes, there are people desperately trying to keep them closed. And that the only way that we are going to succeed in keeping our eyes open, keeping our movement bright and sprite, I got to work out a little bit, maybe a little bit, but is if we stand in solidarity together against racism, against oppression and repression in all forms. So you see, I'm not your regular type of politician, because I understand that the change we're trying to make, it doesn't happen by me shaking hands with some rich billionaire. It doesn't happen with me becoming golf buddies with some rich SOB. It happens when the people in this room, when the people across this country, when trade unionists and activists and black folks and white folks and Asian folks and Arab folks and Jewish folks and gay folks and straight folks and trans folks raise their fists up in solidarity together and demand the change that we so desperately need. So when the Alliance came to me as a little tiny baby alderman in my first term and said, Carlos, will you sign on to CPAC? I said, absolutely, yes, I will stand with you as you demand justice. And when they said, Carlos, Will you introduce this ordinance so that we can have this legislative fight on the floor of the city council? I said, absolutely, yes. Let's take our fight from the streets into the halls of power. And when the aldermen in that city hall refused to listen to us, when they refused to stand with us, we went out there and we knocked doors and we sent a ton of them packing. And so it was this movement for CPAC, this demand for community control of the police, this demand for democracy to have people power in the halls of the city of Chicago that led to the election of six socialists to join me on that city council. It is so beautiful to see this multiracial working class movement coming together. It is so beautiful. And I just want to say thank you, thank you, thank you. From the bottom of my queer Latinx heart, thank you, thank you, thank you. Because this is the movement. This is the movement that's going to get immigrant kids out of jails, that's going to get black folks out of jails, that's going to abolish this unjust, racist, oppressive system and set all of us free. Thank you, Angela. Thank you. Thank you.
And let me just say something, okay? Because we know there are a couple of other ordinances for police accountability, right? But we know that CPAC is a movement, right? There's no other ordinance for police accountability that has 800 people at the CTU hall. There's no other ordinance for police accountability that has 60,000 supporters, black people, brown people, a unified movement in the city fighting for community control of the police. So that way, we can begin to end police crimes and leave them behind in history. Is that right? So up next, I would like to invite up my dear mentor, Frank Chapman.
Okay, I got an old slogan for you. Of course, I'm not old, I just got an old slogan.
We love you, Frank!
All power to the people. All power to the people. Every goddamn bit of it. All power to the people. Okay, we came here to fight. I'm gonna be brief. I'm gonna announce it, and then I'm not gonna make a long speech. Because that's usually what happens, right? So good evening, comrades. Good evening, freedom fighters. Good evening to every one of you. I'm cutting the rest of this paragraph. We know why we have come here tonight. We're here because we all know and realize that we have come to the point when we have to make a renewed and powerful commitment to end, to overturn the regime of racist and political repression perpetrated against our people by those outlaws who currently occupy the White House and their cohorts in Chicago, in St. Louis, in Minnesota, Baltimore, D.C. You know, it's over 100 cities represented here. Every day we hear about impeachment, about Trump's messing with the enemy abroad to steal an election at home. We do not hear about impeaching Trump for ordering thousands of immigrants into detention camps and caging children. We do not hear one word about impeaching Trump for his support of white supremacist terrorists. The law says a president can be impeached for high crimes and misdemeanors, while obviously this doesn't include telling over 10,000 lies while in the Oval Office or implementing policies whose consequences mean the death of children and separation of families. Trump ought to be impeached not just for high crimes and misdemeanors or obstruction of justice, but for crimes against humanity. Under the banner of white supremacy, misogyny, and homophobia, he ought to be impeached for making himself the commander-in-chief of the Klan and the Nazis and all the white supremacist scum of the land. But we must caution ourselves not to think that justice is achieved through the prosecution of one person, even if that person is guilty of crimes against humanity. Let me eliminate that paragraph. Let me go back to 1619. The Dutch man of war. That was a slave ship that brought my people to this land to labor. Let me remind you that slave vessel did not come into the New York Harbor passing the Statue of Liberty on its way to Ellis Island. No, they brought us here in chains, and our ancestors in the belly of those ships came here yearning to be free from those chains. Let us be clear. The crimes of the system predate Donald Trump. The crimes of genocide, expropriation, and enslavement of the indigenous population, of turning Africa into a warren, of a commercial war zone for the hunting down and selling into bondage of untold millions, was not started by Donald Trump. These are crimes that echo down through the centuries, going back 400 years. These are crimes legalized in the Constitution, enshrined in monuments, and carved into mountains by those who enslaved us. These are the crimes that render your American dream a nightmare. And these are the crimes that weigh down upon us today in the form of police terror, mass incarceration, and murder and internment on the Mexican border. We are living, fighting, and dying in this moment of history, dealing with this legacy of bondage, finishing the unfinished revolution started by the indigenous people defending their land, by the Africans on those slave ships, and by the millions of workers who came and still come to this conquered land yearning to be free. We have come here tonight to reaffirm and defend our revolutionary traditions. We come here tonight to say that we are not only the hope and the dream of the slave, we are the defenders of the revolution that will realize these hopes and dreams. We did not call you to this refounding conference of the National Alliance Against Race and Political Repression to commemorate or celebrate what we did 46 years ago. We called you here to join us in rededicating ourselves to defend the inalienable democratic right of our people, of oppressed people and workers, to rise up and overthrow their oppression in this present moment of history. We called you here to join us in consolidating and uniting all the pockets of resistance to police tyranny everywhere it exists in the United States of North America, and to inscribe on our banners community control of the police. We called you here to join us in renewing and taking to a new level or to new heights the struggle to free all political prisoners and the wrongfully convicted. We called you here because we share the vision of many of you to abolish the police and prisons and see it as part of the larger vision, changing and abolishing governments that enslave and oppress us. Ending racist and political repression is our central task in this moment of history. There can be no better world in birth without the carrying out of this task. This conference provides an historic opportunity for our movement to come together in a broad united front to defend and advance the struggle for democracy based on an inalienable democratic right of the oppressed and the working class to organize and fight for radical systemic change. We are not fighting for some abstract we the people democracy. We are fighting for a democracy that recognizes our democratic right to rebel and overthrow the powers that be. All right, to save time, Dr. Barbara Ransby, this is to save time. You all know Barbara, but I'm going to let her introduce herself. And then Angela.
Now, how did I get to go between Frank Chapman and Angela Davis? I don't know. I'm going to be very brief. It's wonderful to look out at this crowd this evening, and I think we have to acknowledge, you know, it's wonderful to be in the house of CTU, our social justice, racial justice union, Stacey Davis Gates, Jennifer Johnson, wonderful, strong black women leaders of this union, and we're happy to be a part of this family. It is always a pleasure and an honor to introduce my friend, comrade, and sister Angela Davis. Angela Davis is someone who really does not need an introduction. Y'all know who she is? Yeah. All right. But I'm up here because when Frank Chapman gives an assignment, I usually try to take it. The purpose of this three-day gathering is to revive the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression. Well, our sister Angela Davis knows a little something about racism and about political repression. Angela grew up in a part of the country, Birmingham, Alabama, that was so racist that one of the neighborhoods was called Dynamite Hill because of the white terrorism of the KKK and other such groups. That was Angela Davis's hometown. Her family knew two of the black girls who were blown up in the 16th Street Baptist Church in 1963. So she knew racism before she had a sophisticated analysis of what it meant. But she knew something else. She knew she was the daughter of Miss Sally Davis, a freedom fighter in her own right. She knew that Birmingham was not only the site of bombings and racist attacks, but it was also the site of resistance and activism led by people like the Reverend Fred Shuttlesworth, a militant freedom fighter and black communist in the 1930s. She was produced by a community of activists that stretched from Birmingham to Brooklyn. So as a child and a young adult, she knew racism, and soon she would know political repression as well. Many people came to know the name Angela Davis based on events in the late 1970s that propelled her into national and international attention. She was unfairly implicated in a shooting in a California courtroom in which young Jonathan Jackson, a 17-year-old brother of political activist and prisoner George Jackson, used a gun that was registered to Angela. This was the state's opportunity to try to put her away, or so they thought. Fearing that she would not get a fair trial, Angela went underground and was placed on the FBI's most wanted list. She was eventually captured and tried, and the force of an international Free Angela movement forced the state to release her. People all over the world came to know the name of Angela Davis, but that was nearly 50 years ago. And I think it's safe to say that Angela Davis has spent every year of every decade since that paying back the freedom fighters all over the world who fought for her release. And it is not a personal debt or an individual debt, it is a political debt. She has paid us back as a brilliant writer and thinker and theorist. She has paid us back with her clarity on racial capitalism and heteropatriarchy and white supremacy and imperialism. The author and editor of almost a dozen books, she has paid us back also as an activist, an organizer, a collaborator, a bridge builder, and a radical internationalist. She has shown up for the Palestinians, she has shown up for Puerto Rico, she has shown up for indigenous folks and queer folks and for incarcerated people. And what we owe her as a freedom fighter and visionary, as an unrelenting feminist and anti-capitalist, is truly priceless. So join me in giving Angela Y. Davis a warm Chicago welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Barbara. And good evening. It's really wonderful to be here this evening. And I'd like to thank the organizers of this conference, Refounding the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression, for inviting me to share this experience with you this evening. It's really energizing to be in this space here in the Chicago Teachers Union Hall. Thank you, Stacey Davis Gates, and the Chicago Teachers Union for your militancy, for your commitment, for your perseverance. It was also really wonderful to hear from Razmir O'Day, who really belongs in this hall today. 46 years ago, we founded the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression here in the city of Chicago. At that time, it was crystal clear that if we did not create a broad alliance of organizations and individuals dedicated to defending movements struggling for progressive and radical change, the resources of existing organizations would be consumed by lawyers' fees and by campaigns to defend those who had been targeted by state repression. Before we do anything else, I want us to pay tribute to the person whose political and organizational vision led to the creation of the alliance. And I'm referring to Charlene Mitchell. And as the head of the National United Committee to Free Angela Davis and All Political Prisoners, she was the one who first conceptualized the kind of defense organization that would generate the resources necessary to protect those who were targeted by political repression. And at the same time, to recognize and contest the ways in which state apparatuses were normalizing racist repression. Let me also recognize the ongoing legacy of some of the leaders of the Chicago Alliance. And I'm referring to Josephine Wyatt and Clarice Dunham, who were dedicated Alliance leaders until their death. And I also, of course, acknowledge the work that Frank Chapman has done, Ted Pearson, Mildred Williamson. I see Sandra Lowe in the audience and many others here in Chicago. I see in terms of the National Alliance, Ann Mitchell is somewhere in the house. I see Cormanita Marr, and I see Linda Jackson, who I've seen in many years. Before I address the... Is there something wrong with the... What's going on with the microphone? Oh, you do? Okay, I thought it was going
check,
in
check,
and
check,
out.
Check, check.
I think the other one was working better. Here, give me the other one back. Okay. So before I address the overarching questions I've been asked to speak to, why we need such an organization today, I want to linger a bit longer in the years that constituted the historical precedent for this gathering. And you know, first of all, I want to say thank you once more to all of those who were involved in the campaign to free me from the repressive hold of the state almost a half century ago. I can't believe it's been almost 50 years. And you should know that when I was arrested, I had about $600 in the bank, which was about enough to pay my rent of the next month. Had it been up to me as an individual, I never would have been able to hire a lawyer. But very quickly, a legal defense fund was created with ties to many artists. And I'm remembering, I know I'm going to forget many names, but Marvell Cook, for example, Ossie Davis was the head of the Legal Defense Committee. The National Conference of Black Lawyers, which I understand is also being revived. Am I right? And there were lawyers who were members of the Communist Party, and lawyers from the National Lawyers Guild, and from the Center for Constitutional Rights, and the ACLU. But of course, the heart of the campaign consisted of people from every walk of life, working class people, especially union members, academics, and students, and fraternity and sorority members. To this day, I am claimed both by the Deltas and the AKAs. And they both tirelessly worked on the campaign for my freedom. People from churches and synagogues and mosques within the Presbyterian Church, people are still talking about the controversy surrounding the $10,000 the church donated to the Legal Defense Fund. And then, of course, there was the international dimension of the campaign, which allows us to recall how important it was to have access to structures of internationalism, such as those that emanated at that time from communist parties all over the world. From the time I was first arrested in New York and held in the Women's House of Detention in Greenwich Village, I could look around and see countless numbers of women who did not have the kind of support networks that quickly developed around my case. And I felt that as long as the campaign focused exclusively on me, we would not be fulfilling our revolutionary mandate. And I could not myself feel comfortable being the sole beneficiary of this phenomenal campaign. And at some point, there was a shift and a change of name from the National United Committee to Free Angela Davis to the National United Committee to Free Angela Davis and All Political Prisoners. And of course, then that led to the creation of the Alliance. But before the National Alliance Against Racist and Political Repression was formally created in May of 1973, we tried to guarantee that our alliance would acknowledge the various and diverse ways in which state repression was being inflicted on different movements. It was, of course, in the early 70s. It was the aftermath of the assassination of Dr. King. There were so many black movements under attack. And we chose to focus on the Attica brothers. We chose to give special attention to Carolina. Seems like when I turn in this direction, when I turn to the right, my voice disappears. But I also want to recall that there was a federal assault on organized indigenous resistance at Wounded Knee. And so in preparation for the founding of the Alliance, a few of us constituted a delegation and went to Wounded Knee. And as a matter of fact, Clyde Bellacour, one of the founders of the American Indian Movement, became a co-chair of the Alliance. And then, of course, there was the Chicano-Latino movement. I can think about Los Siete de la Raza in California and Carlos Feliciano from the Puerto Rican Nationalist Party, Lolita Lebron and Rafael Cancel Miranda and the Puerto Rican Nationalists. There was also Nelson Mandela. We were very insistent on the multiracial character of the organization and recognized that we could not move forward in the struggle against racism without acknowledging the importance of white people learning how to accept black and brown leadership. A number of new issues were emerging at that time. The question of political prisoners. Who constituted a political prisoner? Our recognition that political prisoners could not be separated from the political use of the prison as an instrument of racism, what we would today call structural racism. And of course, George Jackson and others who were incarcerated at the time assisted us to develop this analysis. We had to learn how to link various modes of repression, which we were able to see very clearly in the state of North Carolina, which had more political prisoners than any other state in the country, more people on death row. We saw the beginnings of control centers, behavior modification centers, the open face of the Ku Klux Klan, cases like the case of Joanne Little, that assisted us to understand how important it was to deal with gender violence, sexual violence, violence against women. Marie Hill, who was 15 years old when she was tried and sentenced to death in 1968 on the basis of a coerced confession. Incidentally, last year, I was in Durham, North Carolina at Duke, and Marie Hill was in the audience. And she said that was the most wonderful night of her life because I talked about the case, and it sounded as if it was a case that was not going to end victoriously. But she was there and committed herself amidst all of the people who were there to continuing the struggle. Since that period of the late 60s and early 70s, we have developed new approaches, more elucidating vocabularies, more revealing analysis. And thanks to feminist scholars and organizers, we've begun to understand more clearly connections and relationalities and intersectionalities. And I think that this is the theme around which I want to craft the remainder of my marks. My remarks, I don't... Oh, you're not even showing me how much time I have. Okay. We have learned from feminist theories and practices that all the women are not white, that all of the blacks are not men, that we cannot simply call for gender justice if we do not also include racial justice, economic justice. We have learned that heteropatriarchy saturates every aspect of our lives. And we've learned that we must not be afraid, whether we are women, non-binary people, men, we should not be afraid to identify it and challenge it. So it means that we have to develop habits of perception and habits of analysis that acknowledge the inadequacies of the conceptual tools that on which we are compelled to rely. racial and economic hierarchies often prevent us from understanding how we can most effectively unite and move forward. And with respect to women's movements, the question to ask, if one woman moves forward but leaves everyone else behind, is this really a blow for women's equality? So we have to beware of these metaphors. What is it called? Shattering the glass ceiling or glass ceiling feminism? This historical moment is defined both by the upsurge in movements, especially feminist, queer, black, trans, disabled movements, climate justice movements, Palestinian solidarity, immigrant rights activism, and of course, also movements against state racism and repression. The notion of a defense organization is not very different from what we were attempting to create 45 years ago, or the Civil Rights Congress that was founded in 1946 as a defense organization, which was involved in cases like the Martinville Seven in Virginia, Willie McGee in Mississippi, Rosalie Ingram in Georgia. But just as the National Alliance could not simply replicate the Civil Rights Congress, because times had changed, conditions were different, a 21st century defense organization cannot simply replicate the 20th century version. In the original work of the Alliance, we focused on getting people out of prison, people like Frank Chapman and Reverend Ben Chavis and the Wilmington Ten. We called for prisoners' rights, but we were just beginning to understand the meaning of prison abolition. Of course, today we have to continue to get people out of jail and to call for decarceration, but at the same time, we have to make very explicit calls for the abolition of the prison entirely. In our work then against racist police violence, we call for control of the police. As a matter of fact, control, community control of the police as opposed to police review commissions. And here in Chicago, of course, you have been working on the Police Accountability Council, and you're leading the way in that respect. It is important, in the meantime, to recognize that we have acquired new insights about how to address state repressive apparatuses, such as the prison, and the police. The questions we face today are different. As prisons and police become increasingly more repressive, we today recognize the extent to which they bear the evidence of the impact of militarization that reflects strategies of the so-called war on terror within local police departments. The fact that so many local police departments have been trained by the Israeli government means that solidarity with Palestine is also a central element of our anti-police work. In general, we might say that we have acquired more complex approaches to issues of repression, issues of repression that refuse to go away. Feminist approaches lead us to insist on connections that we did not necessarily recognize in the past, including the way racism and repression are themselves gendered. And this does not simply mean that we focus on women, which we should, or trans and non-binary people, which we should, but we should also recognize the ways in which policing and prison structures are themselves gendered. We did not necessarily realize 4 decades ago the extent to which policing becomes especially dangerous and often fatal when it's directed at intellectually or psychiatrically disabled people. We did not necessarily understand the extent to which anti-immigrant repression, including ICE and all of the detention facilities, which are often private prisons. So I was saying that. You heard me, though, didn't you? I was saying that detention facilities that are often private prisons, and they are deeply linked to other apparatuses of repression. We did not necessarily understand how important it is to challenge carceral feminism and to propose new ways of dealing with the most pandemic forms of violence in the world, sexual violence and gender violence. And I should say that even though impulsively we are all happy when we hear that a police officer has been convicted, we have to also ask ourselves whether we are not thinking about different modes of justice, whether we should not also be thinking about ways of addressing existing problems that do not necessarily rely on the police and on prisons. Internationalist approaches, in the absence of the kind of communist internationalism we once knew, is these approaches are also a major challenge. So how can we actively support struggles in Palestine, in Rojava, and other Kurdish struggles in Kashmir, in Chile? We have a great deal to learn from Brazil and their efforts to push back the repression that is a sign of the Bolsonaro regime. And I should say we should ask ourselves how we can support those who are determined to bring anti-racism and feminism and socialism and climate justice and democracy to Brazil in the spirit of Marielle Franco. And of course, of considering the situation in the Philippines, and I see there's some really energetic members of the delegation from Filipino struggles. And let's not forget that when we talk about the occupant here, and you know what I mean when I say the occupant, right? Because, you know, naming is a powerful mode. So by withholding the name, we withhold the power. And as a matter of fact, in Brazil, instead of referring to the person I just referred to by name, they often say, "O coisio," which is like, the thing. But these are just a few of the questions confronting this new organization and confronting all of us who see ourselves as participants in political movements to push the planet in a progressive direction, and especially now to overturn and repair the damage wrought by the current reactionary government, and finally to reset our freedom compass. Thank you very much.